Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name's Ed.
And I'm Amanda.
And we're here at Words on the Waves with another interview with Hannah Forsyth. And Hannah is the author of Virtue Capitalists, The Rise and Fall of the Professional Class in the Anglophone World. She's also the author of the very provocatively titled Fucking Capitalism Substack. And so we spoke to her about her thoughts about capitalism.
Mm.
So here's our interview with Hannah Forsyth. We're here at Words on the Waves with Hannah Forsyth. Nice to meet you, Hannah.
Great to be here.
And so tell us all about why you're here at Words on the Waves.
Thank you. Yes, yeah, so I was just on a panel with Sean Scarmer, who wrote a book called A Fair Day's Work, and talking about my book, which is called Virtue Capitalists, The Rise and Fall of the Professional Class in the Anglophone World.
Well, that's a little bit of a mouthful. So would you like to just give us a bit of an overview on the themes of your book and what you hope to achieve with it?
Sure. So I was really interested in class. And so all of our ideas about class had been formed when most people had working class jobs. Mm. And so we had this kind of labour versus capital thing going. But I was my first book was The History of Universities. And so I was interested in what was going on with these people. And as the number of them grew, so that now actually the majority of people have professional jobs, what does that do to our class? Mm. And how has that changed over the course of the 20th century? So I ended up starting in about 1870, which was the beginning of a first kind of surge in professional occupations, and coming up to about 2008.
And did you have a thesis? Were you sort of working towards some sort of idea or?
Well, I wasn't at the time, but as it turns out, every single one of the professions that I looked at had a moral component to their work. And I didn't recognize it for the first couple of years of reading all of their journals and archives. But eventually I came to see that in order to do any of this work, you needed a combination of moral purpose and excellence. So you want to do a really good job, but you also want to do it for good reasons. So if you're an accountant, you need the audit to be correct. Mm. If you're an engineer, you need the maths to make sure that the buildings and the bridges don't fall down. If you're a teacher, you need to care about the ways that your students are growing and developing. If you're a nurse, obviously your care is part of the thing. So the moral dimension of each of these professions became a really important part of this. And what I saw was that people were investing morality in a way that they hoped would result in kind of profit, but a profit that was moral as well as economic.
Like satisfaction. And this is maybe where we disconnect a little bit once we get into the corporate world and we're all just sending emails back and forth. And I know Ed and I share the opinion the corporate world, it can be a little bit soul-destroying at times. Do you think that maybe there is something to be said for, I suppose, having some sort of moral value in the work that you do?
Totally, totally. I mean, the system had significant flaws, right? So the types of moral values that were being brought were often doing as much harm as they were good. Mm. So if we think about the reason why it's the Anglophone world was because when I had a look at the patterns across Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, all exactly the same growth patterns, totally different to the UK. Mm. And I went, oh, so there's something going on about the settler colonies that kind of encouraged the professions to grow in the 19th century. Now, so the kinds of moral values that they are bringing in were also deeply racist, terribly sexist, built hierarchies through society that were exploitative as often as they were good. Right? Mm. So if we think about who really was responsible for the stolen generations in Australia, it's doctors, social workers, nurses, those professions that come with lots of clergy, lots of moral force, but often those went wrong. So I think they were onto something, but it brought with it kind of some serious problems. That began to change in the 60s and 70s, where every one of those professions had a moral crisis, where they began to try to turn those hierarchies upside down. So the social workers had to absolutely disobey their bosses and start being on Aboriginal people's side rather than taking their children away. Mm. You know, but that was a very difficult thing for those to do. And, you know, legal aid began to come in so that the lawyers were not only serving rich people, you know, and so on. Mm. Every one of them went through this. And we're kind of living now with the legacies of both of those systems of kind of steep, in some ways, unfair hierarchies that connect moral values with your status in society, but also kind of the people seeking to turn much of that upside down.
Mm. I'm just thinking about this idea of moral values in the workplace, and I do agree that we don't really have that individual moral values. There's no morality associated with anyone's role, like the desire to make positive change, I guess, is just not there for most people in corporate life. But there is a set of moral values from a organizational, like corporate standpoint, like things around climate change, sustainability, diversity, all of that does exist. There is that moral dimension,
like even if it is culture.
Yeah, even if it is often performative. So I don't know if that's kind of taken a similar position.
I think there was a move from in the late 20th century away from thinking about that virtue as being inhering in your selfhood, and which came with some problems, to something where, that you would manage at a more corporate level. Mm. So because the virtue was part of the work, you couldn't not do it. We ended up with kind of systems for risk and quality management and things like that that were there to ensure that organizations were achieving what they morally said that they were going to do. But we've got a different imperative coming through from management at that time, where kind of finding efficiencies, building productivity becomes their measure of success. And that success becomes often enough the thing that matters most. Mm-hmm. And so we end up then with a conflict between that and with the goodness that you're trying to do, and also lots and lots of forms. Like across all of the professions, many, many will say they spend more time filling out forms than doing their job.
Yeah, a lot of red tape. True. And you have a Substack called Fucking Capitalism.
I do.
And, you know, I often...
Is that like a cheering kind of fucking capitalism, or is it... What's the tone there?
So I write about work, education, and the history of capitalism, but those are my three areas of interest. And so I began my Substack kind of thinking that we could describe the history of fucking capitalism, but we'd also kind of look at strategies for fucking capitalism. Okay. Right? And so I have a little joke on it that I'm trying to fuck capitalism one homegrown vegetable at a time. We live in the Blue Mountains, and my Substack also includes lots of discussion about my chickens.
Amazing. Very I love nice. It. I mean, I'm often lamenting the fact that capitalism and the arts don't mix, and you're here at a writers' festival. What's your feeling on the place of the arts and how that works in society?
Oh, that's such a good question. It's like the arts has been so important to everything, to the growth of our sense of self as a culture, as nations, as humans, and so on. And we've had little spurts, haven't we, sometimes of really great support for the arts, and where we see that kind of wonderful flourishing. But we're not living in that moment right at this moment. And in some way, like, that's terrible because we lose so much. But at the same time, and I feel this as a former academic who's left the university system, where I can now do things. I have I have a lot less money.
Yeah.
But I have a lot more freedom. Mm. And there's kind of something quite wonderful that happens in the arts when you're sitting on the edge, you've not got very much, but gosh, you've got good ideas. And I think that we're seeing a lot of that coming out in the arts at the moment.
So it's almost like the starving artists or the good artists kind of thing. Is that
you don't want to do it, do you? Because people should have good work and be well paid and have enough time to do their art. And, you know, so we want to support them. But there's something special going on, I think, at the moment, just despite the lack of support. Mm.
If only there was an option to be profitable and make money and not destroy your soul. Unfortunately, we're yet to find that one.
Yeah, me too.
But thank you so much, Hannah, for speaking with us. We know you're limited in time, but it's been wonderful.
Great to meet you both.
This has been a special presentation of the Not Quite Right podcast in collaboration with Words on the Waves Writers Festival. Check the show notes for more information about Words on the Waves and the books mentioned in this episode. If you're new to the podcast, please join us again for our regular episodes where we talk about media, culture, and the art of writing.
Something doesn't seem quite right.